The sea breeze off Kingston Harbor carried more than salt. It carried sound. Laughter from street vendors, the call of fishermen hauling nets, and somewhere in the distance, the faint rhythm of a guitar cutting through the evening air. In Greenwich Town, music wasn't something you went to find. It was already in your lungs, your skin, your bones. In 1947, a boy named John Holt took his first breaths in that soundscape. He didn't grow up with fame in mind. He grew up with hymns in church, American R&B on late-night radio, and the pulse of Jamaican mento and ska echoing through the lanes. His voice, smooth and steady, began turning heads before he even knew what a microphone felt like. This episode follows Holt from those formative streets to the heart of Jamaica's emerging music scene. We'll walk with him into the small, crowded halls of early talent shows, where winning wasn't as important as winning over the crowd. We'll stand beside him as he joins the Paragons, shaping rocksteady harmonies that would define an era. And we'll step into the studio on the night The Tide Is High was recorded, a song that would one day circle the globe. Then, just when it seemed the harmony was set for life, Holt stepped out of the group's shadow, alone on stage for the first time, with nothing but his voice and the crowd's curiosity. He began building a solo career that would carry him further than he'd ever imagined. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 1. Roots in Kingston. Greenwich Town, late 1940 to 1950. The sea air in Greenwich Town always carried a mix of salt, diesel, and frying fish. It was a neighborhood perched on the edge of Kingston's harbor, a working-class stretch where life moved to the sound of hammers against boat hulls, the cries of market women, and the occasional blast from a passing ship. This was where John Holt first opened his eyes in 1947, in a Jamaica still feeling the tremors of the Second World War. The island was technically still a British colony, but its people were beginning to lean more heavily into their own voice, in politics, in trade, and especially in music. I'm standing on those same streets decades later, notebook in hand, trying to picture what they looked like in Holt's time. The shoreline is the same, the sea still restless against the pier, but the houses have changed. Many of the original wooden board homes are gone, replaced by cement blocks painted in bright Caribbean colors. But the spirit, the steady hum of community, is still here. I imagine a young boy running barefoot along these lanes, chasing after friends, his voice already carrying the clarity that would one day fill concert halls. In the Kingston of Holt's childhood, the city center was a bustling, noisy mix of street vendors, dock workers, and school children in crisp uniforms. Greenwich Town itself was a self-contained community. If you grew up here, you knew everyone. And if you could sing, word spread quickly. Early family life. John Holt was the youngest of several children, born into a family that lived simply but worked hard. His father found work at the docks, offloading cargo ships under the blistering Caribbean sun. His mother managed the home and sold small goods in the local market. In households like theirs, music wasn't a luxury. It was woven into daily life. Hymns were sung during evening prayers, mento tunes played at Saturday gatherings, and neighbors often sang together while working. Holt's earliest memories of music came from his mother's voice. She wasn't a professional singer, but she had a warm, steady tone and a way of bending notes that made even familiar hymns sound fresh. Sunday mornings meant church, and church meant music, organs, tambourines, and a congregation singing in harmonies that seemed to lift the roof. For young John, it wasn't simply the sound that mattered. It was the way songs brought people together, how voices from different corners of the neighborhood merged into something bigger than any one person. Greenwich Town's tight-knit nature meant that elders kept an eye on the youth. If John skipped a school lesson, someone would tell his parents before the day was done. If he sang at a street corner and someone recognized a natural gift, they made sure his family knew. This quiet network of care helped shape Holt's discipline and gave him a sense of responsibility from an early age. Evenings at home were modest. Dinner might be fish caught earlier in the day, yam, or breadfruit roasted over an open flame. Afterward, the family would sit together, sometimes listening to the radio if they could get a clear signal, other times talking or singing. Electricity was unreliable, so on dark nights, lantern light cast warm glows across the small wooden rooms. In that glow, Holt's imagination grew. Childhood environment. In the 1950s, Greenwich Town was alive with music, but not in the way we think of today. There were no giant speakers pounding bass lines into the night just yet. Instead, music moved through narrow lanes in the voices of men playing acoustic guitars, women humming while washing clothes, and fishermen whistling as they mended nets. Ska had not yet taken over Jamaica, but Mento was a mainstay and American R&B, carried over the airwaves from Florida and New Orleans, was beginning to sneak into local ears. Holt, like many boys his age, became fascinated with these sounds. The radio, when it worked, brought in the voices of Sam Cooke, Nat King Cole, and the Drifters. Their smooth harmonies and heartfelt delivery left a mark on him. The local school John attended had a small music program. It wasn't much, a handful of instruments and a teacher who doubled as choir director. But it was enough to give him structure. His teacher noticed his pitch and tone early on, and often called on him to lead class songs. That recognition boosted his confidence, though Holt himself remained quiet and humble. Markets were another source of musical inspiration. On weekends, vendors gathered not just to sell goods but to socialize. Fiddlers, drummers, and singers would set up near the stalls, turning an ordinary shopping trip into a mini-concert. John would stand close, studying how the older men kept time with their feet, how they shifted from one song to another without losing the crowd's attention. The streets themselves were a classroom. He saw how music could calm disputes, draw people together, and mark important moments. In a place where money was scarce, music was one of the few riches everyone could share. First signs of musical talent. John's first stage was a church pulpit. At around age 8, he began singing solos during Sunday services. His voice was high and clear, with a natural vibrato that made older church members take notice. Soon after, he was invited to sing at school concerts. By his early teens, he was entering local talent contests, a popular form of entertainment across Kingston. One of these contests, held in a neighborhood hall, was a turning point. The prize wasn't money, but a chance to record a song at a small local studio. Holt didn't win that night, but the crowd's reaction stayed with him. People he didn't know came up afterward to shake his hand and tell him to keep going. That encouragement mattered more than any trophy. Back on the streets, Holt sang with friends at evening hangouts. They would gather on a corner, harmonizing to popular American songs and experimenting with local styles. It was here that he began to understand harmony, rhythm, and the importance of blending voices, skills that would later serve him well in the Paragons. Some elders in the neighborhood began calling him the boy with the golden voice. The nickname stuck, and with it came a certain responsibility. People expected him to sing at events, whether he was ready or not. This expectation forced him to practice, to refine his tone, and to take music seriously. Post-war Jamaica and music scene. By the late 1950s, Jamaica was in transition. Political movements were pushing toward independence, which would finally come in 1962. In the streets, that energy translated into music. The sound systems were beginning to rise. Large speaker setups that played records at outdoor dances. Ska, with its brisk tempo and upbeat horns, was gaining popularity. But in communities like Greenwich Town, the older styles still held sway, and Holt grew up in a mix of tradition and innovation. Musical gatherings weren't just about entertainment. They were about identity. Young people were blending influences from American rhythm and blues with local folk traditions, creating something uniquely Jamaican. For Holt, these events were an education in more than just music. They were lessons in crowd dynamics, cultural pride, and the role of art in political expression. Money was tight and opportunities were few, but the sense of possibility was real. Anyone with talent, drive, and the right break could rise from a Kingston neighborhood to national fame. Holt was beginning to see that path for himself. Standing on the shoreline today, you can still feel the heartbeat of Greenwich Town in the slap of waves against the pier and the voices drifting from open doorways. This is where John Holt's story began, in a place that valued hard work, community, and music in equal measure. His journey from these narrow streets to the world stage was about to take its first major turn. The next chapter would find him stepping into a group that would define an era, the Paragons. Chapter 2, First Steps into Music. A reggae evening in Kingston, late 1950. The hall was small, crowded, and hot. The kind of heat that clung to your shirt and made the wooden floor slick under your shoes. Colored light bulbs dangled from a low ceiling, casting soft red and yellow glows over the crowd. In one corner, a makeshift stage held a microphone propped up with electrical tape and a single speaker humming with feedback. It wasn't much, but to a teenager named John Holt, it might as well have been the National Stadium. The crowd was restless, a mix of teenagers in their best pressed shirts and skirts, and older folks sipping Red Stripe from glass bottles. The host, a local MC with a booming voice, stepped up, calling out the next name in the evening's talent showcase. Holt, just in his early teens, took a deep breath and walked forward. He didn't have a band behind him, only a backing track spun by the DJ, but the moment the first notes played, the noise in the room quieted. He sang an American R&B tune, one he'd learned from listening to late-night radio broadcasts from Miami. His delivery wasn't perfect, but it had something the crowd recognized: sincerity. By the time he finished, the applause was loud enough to drown out the buzzing speaker. He didn't win first prize that night, but for Holt, the real victory was feeling the audience respond. Neighborhood talent shows and early confidence. In the Kingston of Holt's youth, talent contests were more than entertainment. They were a proving ground. You could be a dock worker by day and still be known across the neighborhood for your singing voice if you held your own at a Friday night show. These events were cheap to attend, often organized by community groups or local bar owners, and they drew in crowds eager to hear fresh talent. Holt entered several of these competitions. Sometimes he performed solo, other times he teamed up with friends to harmonize on popular songs. The format was usually simple. Each contestant got one song, sometimes two if the crowd demanded an encore. Judges were informal, usually respected community members or musicians, and the prize was often small: a few pounds, a gift certificate, or a promise of a studio session. For Holt, the real prize was the practice. Standing in front of an audience, learning how to hold a note even when nerves tried to shake it, figuring out when to lean into a lyric to get a reaction. These were skills no classroom could teach. Each contest added a layer to his confidence, even the ones he didn't win. School days and musical encouragement. At school, Holt's talent didn't go unnoticed. His music teacher had a sharp ear and a knack for spotting potential. She often chose him to lead group songs during assemblies. On more than one occasion, she pulled him aside to tell him he had a voice worth something, encouraging him to keep practicing outside of class. Music at school was simple: a few wooden recorders, a battered piano, and an old drum set, but it provided structure. Holt learned timing, pitch, and how to follow cues from other musicians. He also began experimenting with harmony, pairing up with classmates to create layered vocals that mimicked the American doo-wop style. Even in subjects unrelated to music, Holt showed quiet determination. He wasn't the loudest in class, but he paid attention, absorbing details and storing them away. That patience and focus would later serve him in recording studios, where precision was as important as passion. Early bandmates and informal groups. By his mid-teens, Holt began singing with a loose group of neighborhood musicians. They weren't officially a band, more like a rotating set of friends who brought their instruments to whichever yard had space for a practice. A battered acoustic guitar, a pair of conga drums, and voices were all they needed. These sessions often started in the late afternoon and ran until well past dark. Neighbors would lean on fences to listen, children would gather at the edges, and someone would inevitably start selling fried fish or roasted corn to the growing crowd. The group covered popular Mento and Calypso songs, slipped in American hits, and experimented with original lyrics. Through these gatherings, Holt learned the value of musical chemistry. He noticed how certain voices blended better than others, how timing between instruments could lift or sink a song, and how even a small audience reacted differently to upbeat rhythms versus slower ballads. Dance halls and the expanding sound. While street sessions kept him grounded in the community, dance halls exposed Holt to a larger world. These were the venues where sound systems were making their mark. Large wooden speaker boxes pumped out ska, R&B, and local hits to packed rooms. DJs spun records from both Jamaica and abroad, and singers would sometimes take the mic for a live performance between tracks. Holt wasn't yet a featured act, but he studied every performer who stepped on stage. He saw how experienced singers controlled the room, when they spoke to the audience, when they let the music breathe. He noticed which songs drew the biggest reactions and began shaping his own style accordingly. Dance halls also gave him a better understanding of where Jamaican music was headed. Ska was rising fast, blending the upbeat tempo of Mento with the horn-driven punch of jazz and the influence of American rhythm and blues. Holt's natural voice, smooth, melodic, and rich in tone, fit perfectly into this evolving soundscape, preparing for the next step. By the time Holt reached his late teens, he had built a quiet but solid reputation in Kingston's music circles. He wasn't yet a household name, but among musicians and talent scouts, his voice was known. The consistency of his performances, combined with his adaptability, moving seamlessly from American ballads to local ska, made him stand out. It was during this period that whispers began about a vocal group looking for a strong lead singer. That opportunity would lead him to the Paragons, the group that would change his career forever. The road from street corners to professional studios was short in distance, but long in work. John Holt had spent his teenage years building the foundation, learning stagecraft, refining his tone, and understanding the rhythm of an audience. Soon, he would step into the recording booth as part of one of Jamaica's most influential rocksteady groups. The boy from Greenwich Town was about to become a voice that would travel far beyond Kingston's shores. Chapter 3. The Paragons Era Begins. A small Kingston studio, mid-1960. The studio smelled faintly of wood polish and warm electronics. In one corner, a reel-to-reel tape machine waited, its silver spools ready to capture whatever came next. The air was thick with anticipation, the kind that settles in when a group knows they're about to create something important, even if they can't quite see how big it will be. John Holt stood near the single-ribbon microphone, one hand in his pocket, the other resting loosely at his side. Around him were the men who would become his musical family: Tyrone Evans, Howard Barrett, and occasionally Bob Andy. They weren't dressed like stars. There were no flashy suits yet, only neat shirts and well-pressed trousers. But their harmonies? Those were already immaculate. This was the Paragons at the dawn of their era, a group not yet weighed down by fame, but already shaping the sound of what would later be called rocksteady. Joining the group, Holt's invitation to join the Paragons came through a mix of luck and reputation. Tyrone Evans had heard him sing at a small venue and was struck by his control and tone. The group, still in its formative stage, needed a strong lead vocalist who could balance romance with rhythm. Howard Barrett recalled years later, "We knew right away he had something rare. His voice wasn't just good. It was steady, reliable, and it carried emotion without forcing it." Holt accepted quickly, though he understood the stakes. Joining a group meant commitment, long rehearsals, and the unspoken rule that harmony came first. No single voice could overshadow the whole. Defining the Paragons' sound. The Paragons were born in a transitional moment for Jamaican music. Ska was beginning to slow down, making way for rocksteady, a smoother, more soulful style that allowed vocals to shine. This shift played perfectly to Holt's strengths. Rehearsals were serious affairs. They often met in yards or cramped backrooms, practicing for hours until every blend and pause felt natural. The group's sound became defined by tight harmonies, simple but effective arrangements, and a lyrical style that leaned heavily on themes of love, longing, and resilience. Holt's role as lead singer wasn't about dominating the track. It was about guiding it, setting the emotional tone while giving space for the others' harmonies to bloom. First studio sessions. Their early recording days were modest. The studios were small, the equipment basic, but the engineers knew how to make the most of what they had. Songs were often recorded in one or two takes. Mistakes had to be worked around. Editing technology was limited, so the pressure to get it right was immediate. One of the first tracks they cut together showcased Holt's ability to move seamlessly from a smooth verse to a soaring chorus. The engineers noticed it too. "He never strained," one recalled. "His high notes sounded as natural as speaking." These first sessions built the trust between Holt and the rest of the group. They learned each other's timing, when to push, when to pull back, and how to adjust mid-song if something went off. Early performances and building a fan base. Before radio hits, the Paragons built their name live. They performed at community centers, dance halls, and open-air shows, often sharing the bill with other rising stars. Holt had a quiet stage presence. He didn't jump or dance wildly, but his stillness drew attention. When he sang, the audience leaned in, as if not to miss a single word. That ability to hold a crowd without theatrics became part of the group's appeal. The early fan base was a mix of young couples, drawn to the romantic ballads, and music lovers who appreciated the clean, precise harmonies. Word of mouth was powerful. A good performance could double their audience the next time they played. Entering the Rocksteady era. By 1966, Rocksteady was in full swing, and the Paragons were riding the wave. Their music fit perfectly with the slower tempo and more spacious arrangements that defined the genre. The bass lines were warmer, the guitar skank more measured, and the vocal harmonies more prominent. For Holt, this was the ideal environment. The slower pace allowed him to stretch notes, linger on phrases, and let the emotion of a lyric settle before moving on. His ballad style, romantic yet unforced, became a signature of the group's sound. The chemistry that made them work. Success in a vocal group is as much about personality as talent. The Paragons had their disagreements, but they shared a work ethic and mutual respect that kept them together through the demanding early years. Holt's humility played a big role. Despite his standout voice, he never treated himself as the star. That balance made the group stronger, ensuring that every member's contribution mattered. They also shared an instinct for knowing which songs suited them best. They didn't chase trends blindly. They focused on material that matched their style and their strengths. In those first years, the Paragons weren't yet legends. They were four young men in Kingston trying to make music that mattered, and succeeding, one show and one recording at a time. For John Holt, joining the group wasn't just a career move. It was the start of a chapter that would cement his place in reggae history. The next step would take them from local favorites to national icons with a song that would travel the globe. The Tide is High. Chapter 4. The Tide is High. A late night studio in Kingston, 1967. The clock on the wall read just past midnight, but no one seemed to notice. The small Kingston studio was alive with the quiet intensity of a band chasing something special. Cigarette smoke curled lazily toward the ceiling, mingling with the warm scent of wood and hot electrical equipment. John Holt stood close to the microphone, eyes half closed, listening to the soft count-in from the engineer's booth. Behind him, the other members of the Paragons shifted their weight, ready to blend their voices into the harmony they had rehearsed for weeks. They were about to record a song that had begun as a simple idea, a melody Holt had been carrying around for months. In a few short hours, it would become a track that would outlive its creators, a song that would cross oceans, decades, and genres. The Tide is High. The spark of an idea. Holt often described the beginnings of The Tide as high as quiet, almost accidental. He had been walking home one afternoon, humming a tune without thinking, when the opening line came to him. It wasn't a grand moment of inspiration, just a phrase that seemed to carry both calm and longing. The lyrics started to form in his head, simple, conversational, yet filled with emotion. Holt's style had always leaned toward words that people could relate to instantly. He wasn't trying to impress with complexity. He was telling a story anyone could feel. That story, he decided, would be about persistence and love. The imagery of the tide, something constant, powerful, and unrelenting, fit perfectly, bringing it to the Paragons. When Holt shared the idea with Tyrone Evans and Howard Barrett, they immediately saw the potential. The melody was strong, and the lyrics had that balance of romance and strength that the Paragons were becoming known for. The group began working through the arrangement in rehearsals. The verses flowed easily, but finding the right balance in the chorus took time. They wanted it to feel uplifting without losing the smoothness that defined Rocksteady. Howard Barrett later recalled, "We must have sung that chorus 100 times in one night, trying to get the timing right. But when it clicked, we knew it." The recording session. Recording The Tide is High was both simple and demanding. Simple because the song's structure was straightforward. No extended solos, no complicated key changes. Demanding because Rocksteady left no room to hide. Every note, every harmony had to be perfect. The band laid down the rhythm track first. The bass carried a warm, rolling pulse, while the guitar kept a steady skank on the offbeat. A light horn section added color without overpowering the vocals. When it came time for Holt's lead vocal, the studio fell into silence. He delivered the verses with a relaxed confidence, letting the words breathe. In the chorus, his voice rose just enough to lift the song, while the harmonies wrapped around him like a tide themselves. The take they kept wasn't the first, but it wasn't far from it. By the end of the night, they knew they had something worth holding on to. Release and reception in Jamaica. When The Tide is High was released in 1967, it quickly found its place on Jamaican radio. It wasn't the fastest-selling single of the year, but it had staying power. Couples requested it at dances, DJs kept it in their rotation, and soon it became a slow dance favorite. Its charm was in its universality. It spoke to anyone who had ever waited for love, fought for love, or believed in love's return. In local performances, the song became a highlight of the Paragon's set list. Audiences sang along to the chorus, sometimes loud enough to drown out the microphones. Crossing Oceans. The song's journey didn't end in Jamaica. Through the networks of Caribbean migration and record trading, The Tide Is High found its way to the United Kingdom. There, it resonated with the growing reggae and rocksteady scenes in London, Birmingham, and other cities with large West Indian communities. By the early 1970s, it was a cult favorite among UK reggae fans. That reputation would set the stage for its later reinvention by Blondie in 1980. A cover that would top charts worldwide, but still carry the DNA of Holt's original composition. Legacy within the Paragon's era. While The Tide Is High wasn't their only hit, it became the song most associated with the Paragon's name outside Jamaica. For Holt, it was a turning point, proof that his songwriting could travel far beyond Kingston's shores. He remained proud of the track, even as it was reinterpreted by other artists. In interviews years later, he often smiled when talking about it, calling it a song that just wouldn't go away. In that cramped Kingston studio, the Paragons had no idea they were creating a piece of music that would live on for decades. For them, it was just another session, another song to add to their growing catalog. But for the world, it was the beginning of a love affair with a melody and a message that never lost its tide. The success of The Tide Is High would carry the Paragons into a new phase, one where their name meant more than just another group in the rocksteady era. And for John Holt, it was a sign that his voice and his pen were capable of shaping the course of Jamaican music. Chapter 5. Paragon's Peak Years. Kingston, 1968, Outdoor Night Concert. The open-air venue was buzzing long before the first note was played. Strings of colored lights hung between bamboo poles, casting soft glows over a restless crowd. The air was thick with the scent of jerked chicken, roasted corn, and rum punch. Vendors shouted over the din, selling everything from roasted peanuts to paper cones of shaved ice. On stage, four microphones stood waiting under the glare of spotlights that hummed faintly in the night air. The MC, dressed in a crisp suit, stepped forward and bellowed into the mic. "Ladies and gentlemen, the Paragons." A roar went up from the audience. As the group took the stage, John Holt gave a small nod to the band. The first notes of Only a Smile floated out, and instantly the crowd swayed. The harmonies were seamless, Holt's voice cutting through with warmth and clarity. For the next hour, they had the audience in their hands, a growing catalog of hits. Following the breakout success of The Tide Is High, the Paragons poured their focus into recording and performing. The late 1960s became their golden period, with songs like Only a Smile, Were You to the Ball, and On the Beach climbing Jamaican charts and becoming staples at dances across the island. Their approach to music was methodical. Each track began with Holt bringing a melody or lyric to rehearsal. The group would then shape it together, adjusting harmonies, reworking verses, and deciding on arrangement details. They favored songs that blended romantic storytelling with melodies that were easy to remember, a formula that kept them in steady rotation on local radio. Touring Jamaica. During this era, the Paragons became one of the most in-demand live acts in Jamaica. They traveled from Kingston to rural parishes, performing at community festivals, seaside resorts, and special holiday events. Touring in those days was far from glamorous. The group often piled into small vans with their instruments and a few changes of clothes. Roads outside Kingston could be rough, and long journeys meant stopping in small towns to eat and rest before continuing on to the next gig. Despite the challenges, these tours helped them reach audiences who rarely saw major acts. For many in rural areas, a Paragon's performance was a highlight of the year. Crowds often gathered hours early, lining the edges of makeshift stages to secure the best view. The sound of rocksteady maturing. By 1968, rocksteady was evolving. While the basic offbeat guitar skank and steady bass remained, arrangements were becoming more refined. Producers were experimenting with string sections, horn arrangements, and more layered vocal harmonies. The Paragons adapted easily. Holt's smooth vocal delivery worked well against richer instrumentals, and the group's tight harmonies gave producers plenty to work with. They recorded with some of Jamaica's top session musicians, who added polish without sacrificing the organic feel of the music. In the studio, Holt's leadership was clear. He had a knack for hearing when a take was the one, often calling it before the engineers did. That confidence saved time and gave the group a reputation for professionalism. Iconic songs and cultural presence. Two songs from this period stood out for their lasting impact. On the Beach and Where You to the Ball. On the Beach captured the relaxed, joyful side of Jamaican life. Warm sand, ocean breeze, and romance under the stars. It became an anthem for seaside dances and resort shows, appealing to both locals and tourists. Where You to the Ball, on the other hand, carried a sense of aspiration and charm. Its playful lyrics and inviting rhythm made it a favorite among younger fans. Both tracks showcase the Paragon's ability to balance elegance and accessibility. Media and public recognition. By now, the Paragons were more than just a musical group. They were public figures. Their images appeared in music magazines, on concert posters, and in promotional materials for sound system events. Radio interviews became more frequent, with Holt often taking the lead in answering questions about songwriting and the group's creative process. In these interviews, Holt's humility shone through. He often credited the group's success to teamwork and the support of their producers, rarely speaking of himself as the driving force, even though many in the industry knew he was. International interest. Word of the Paragon's success reached beyond Jamaica. Record shops in the UK, especially in neighborhoods with large Caribbean populations, began importing their singles. West Indian immigrants in London, Birmingham, and Manchester embraced the music as a connection to home. This overseas interest laid the groundwork for future tours and collaborations. While the group's focus remained in Jamaica during this peak period, they were aware that a much larger audience was waiting across the Atlantic. Challenges beneath the surface. As with many groups, the pressures of constant recording and performing began to take a toll. Scheduling conflicts, creative disagreements, and the financial realities of the music business created tension. While these issues didn't immediately threaten the group's stability, they planted seeds for future changes. Holt, always dedicated to his craft, began to consider what he might achieve as a solo artist. The late 1960s marked the height of the Paragon's influence. They were at the center of Jamaica's vibrant music scene, producing songs that would define the rocksteady era and inspire generations to come. But even in these peak years, John Holt was quietly preparing for the next chapter, one where his voice would carry his name alone, without the cushion of a group. Next came a leap of faith, stepping out from the harmony into the spotlight as a solo artist. Chapter 6, Solo Career Launch. Kingston, early 1970, first solo performance. The stage was smaller than the ones John Holt had grown used to with the Paragons, but the weight on his shoulders felt heavier. No harmonies to lean on, no shared spotlight. Just him, a microphone, and a room full of people waiting to see if the voice they loved in a group could stand alone. It was a midweek night at a well-known Kingston club. The crowd was mixed, loyal Paragons fans curious about Holt's next move, industry figures listening for potential, and casual music lovers looking for a good set. The house band gave a quick nod, the lights warmed his face, and Holt stepped into the first verse of his debut single. The applause came before the song even finished. He had proven the point. John Holt, on his own, was every bit as commanding as John Holt with a group. The decision to go solo. Holt's departure from the Paragons wasn't abrupt, but it was inevitable. The group's internal pressures, combined with Holt's growing creative ambitions, led him to consider a solo career as early as the late 1960s. He wanted more freedom in song selection, arrangements, and lyrical themes. Friends recall that he never spoke negatively about the Paragons. He saw the group as family. But he also recognized that remaining in a shared format meant compromising on certain artistic choices. As a solo artist, he could follow his instincts without negotiation. First singles and early studio work. Holt's first solo sessions were lean operations. He worked with trusted producers who appreciated his natural phrasing and ability to adapt to different rhythms. His earliest singles as a solo act carried a balance of romantic ballads and socially aware tracks, a combination that would become his trademark. One of his initial standouts, recorded in a Kingston studio known for its warm, analog sound, showed that Holt could carry a song entirely on the strength of his delivery. He layered harmonies over his own lead vocals, giving the track a fullness without other singers in the room. Producers admired his precision. "When Holt walked in," one said years later, "you knew you were getting the take you needed before the night was over." Shaping a solo identity. Moving from group member to solo act required more than just changing the name on a record label. Holt had to establish an image and sound that would distinguish him from his Paragon's years. Visually, he adopted a more polished style, tailored suits for promotional photos, understated elegance on stage. Musically, he leaned deeper into the love ballads that had been fan favorites, while also exploring roots reggae arrangements that gave him space to comment on social issues. This dual approach allowed him to connect with two audiences: the romantic listener who loved his softer side, and the politically aware fan who respected his ability to speak truth through melody. First solo performances. Holt's first solo shows were carefully chosen. He performed in intimate venues where the audience could hear every nuance of his voice. This strategy built credibility. Once people heard him live without a group, their doubts vanished. The reception was immediate. Fans were impressed not only with his voice, but with his composure. On stage, Holt rarely rushed. He let silences breathe between verses, making each lyric land. Critics in local newspapers noted the maturity in his performance style. One review called him a singer who knows exactly how much to give, and never more than the song requires. Industry recognition. By his second year as a solo artist, Holt's work had caught the attention of international labels. His ability to cross from rocksteady roots into reggae and ballad territory made him a versatile asset for producers looking to market Jamaican music abroad. This recognition led to opportunities for studio collaborations and overseas performances. It also brought him into contact with arrangers who introduced new instrumental textures into his songs: strings, layered horns, and softer rhythm sections for ballads. Building a solo catalog. Within a short period, Holt began releasing singles at a steady pace. Some leaned into romantic storytelling, others carried pointed commentary on the changing political climate in Jamaica. His growing catalog showed he wasn't afraid to experiment with tempo, instrumentation, or lyrical tone. Unlike many artists who relied heavily on producers for song ideas, Holt wrote much of his own material. This ensured that even as styles shifted in the 1970s, his music retained a distinct voice. Audience loyalty. Perhaps the strongest sign of Holt's success in this period was the loyalty of his audience. Fans who had followed him from the Paragon's era stayed with him, while new listeners discovered him through his solo work. At concerts, people still called out for Paragon's hits, but they also sang along to his new material. It was clear that Holt had transitioned from being John Holt of the Paragons to simply John Holt. By the mid-1970s, John Holt's solo career was firmly established. He had proven that his voice, songwriting, and stage presence could stand alone, not as an extension of a group, but as the centerpiece of a singular career. The next chapter would cement his place in Jamaican music history, as he became the king of the love song and one of the most recognizable voices in reggae. Chapter 7. Love Song's Legacy. Kingston, 1972, the night Stick By Me took the stage. The lights dimmed, the crowd hushed, and the band played the gentle opening chords of Stick By Me. John Holt stepped to the microphone, one hand lightly gripping the stand, his voice gliding into the first line with a softness that filled every corner of the venue. By the second verse, couples in the crowd had drawn closer together, swaying slowly, mouthing the words as if the song were their own. When the final note faded, the applause was almost too loud for the delicate mood the song had created. Holt smiled faintly, not a showman's grin, but the quiet satisfaction of a man who knew the power of a love song done right. The birth of Stick By Me. The idea for Stick By Me came from Holt's belief that the best love songs were rooted in sincerity. He wanted lyrics that anyone could say to a partner without feeling they belonged only in a song. In interviews, he later said, "I don't sing for the stage first, I sing for the living room. If a song can sit in someone's home and feel true, then it's ready for the stage." The track's arrangement was minimal by design. Soft rhythm guitar, steady bass, gentle percussion, and strings that wrapped around his voice like a slow embrace. It wasn't just another single. It was a statement that Holt's solo career would have a strong romantic core. The impact of Stick By Me. Upon release, the song became an instant favorite in Jamaica and abroad. It topped local charts and found its way into the collections of West Indian households in the UK and Canada. For many, it became the soundtrack to weddings, anniversaries, and late-night radio dedications. Critics praised Holt's ability to balance tenderness and strength in his delivery. He didn't oversing. He let the emotion flow naturally, giving the listener space to feel the song rather than be overwhelmed by it, building the love song catalog. Following the success of Stick By Me, Holt leaned deeper into romantic ballads. Tracks like If I Were a Carpenter, A Love I Can Feel, and I'd Love You to Want Me showcased his versatility in interpreting both original material and covers. He had a gift for making a cover song entirely his own. Even when audiences knew the original, Holt's phrasing and timing transformed it into something uniquely Jamaican. His renditions carried the warmth of rocksteady roots while appealing to international pop sensibilities. Stagecraft for romance. Live, Holt understood that love songs required a different energy than political anthems or up-tempo dance numbers. He kept his movements minimal, focusing on facial expression and vocal delivery. Sometimes he would close his eyes during a chorus, as if singing directly to someone only he could see. This subtlety made audiences lean in. At shows, couples often danced cheek to cheek, and even those without a partner would sway in time with the music. The atmosphere he created was intimate, even in large venues. International recognition. By the mid-1970s, Holt's reputation as reggae's premier love song singer was spreading internationally. Promoters in the UK began marketing his shows specifically to audiences who favored romantic reggae, a subgenre gaining popularity alongside roots and dub. Holt toured with set lists carefully balanced between love songs and socially conscious tracks, ensuring he appealed to the full spectrum of reggae fans. His romantic catalog often served as the emotional high points of the night, drawing the loudest applause and the most audience participation. The emotional resonance of Holt's ballads. Part of Holt's magic was his ability to sing love songs without cliché. Even familiar themes felt fresh in his voice. He avoided unnecessary embellishment, letting the lyrics speak plainly. Fans often described his songs as truthful. They weren't fairy tales. They acknowledged the challenges of relationships while celebrating the enduring desire to hold on to love. That honesty gave his ballads lasting appeal. They weren't tied to a particular decade or trend. Influence on future artists. Younger singers took note. Many credited Holt with showing that romantic reggae could stand alongside, not beneath, the more politically charged side of the genre. His ability to maintain credibility while singing love songs set a standard that others sought to match. Artists across generations have covered his ballads, keeping them alive for audiences too young to have heard the originals on release. This continuing presence in reggae's romantic canon speaks to the strength of the foundation Holt built in this era. The love songs of John Holt weren't background music. They were front and center, carrying the same cultural weight as any anthem or protest track. In the 1970s, he became the voice of romance in reggae, a title he never chased but naturally embodied. And while the world loved him for it, Holt was about to prove that his artistry went beyond matters of the heart, into the urgent and unflinching territory of social commentary. Chapter 8, Reggae Evolution. Opening scene, Kingston, 1975, studio session for a Roots track. The bass was deep enough to rattle the floor. In the control room, smoke curled toward the ceiling as the engineer adjusted the levels. Holt stood before the microphone, headphones on, nodding slightly to the rhythm. The track beneath his voice was heavier than the love songs he had built his name on. The drums more insistent, the guitar sharper, the bass line slower but thicker, pulling each lyric into its orbit. Outside the studio walls, Kingston was alive with political energy and unrest. Elections, street demonstrations, and debates about Jamaica's future filled the air. Inside, Holt was channeling that atmosphere into something new for him, roots reggae with a message. The shift from rocksteady to roots reggae. By the mid-1970s, reggae had taken a decisive turn. Where rocksteady had been smooth and romantic, roots reggae was raw, spiritual, and often political. It reflected the growing influence of Rastafarian culture and the realities of post-independence Jamaica. Poverty, inequality, and a struggle for identity in a globalized world. For Holt, this shift was both a challenge and an opportunity. He had built a career on love songs, but he was also a keen observer of the times. He recognized that reggae was no longer just about rhythm and romance. It had become a platform for truth-telling. Entering the Roots era, Holt's entry into Roots reggae was deliberate. He didn't abandon his romantic material. Fans still expected it. But he began weaving social themes into his albums. The production style shifted too. Heavier bass lines, more prominent drums, and sparse but piercing guitar chops. One of the key influences was his collaboration with producers who were deeply embedded in the Roots scene. They pushed Holt to experiment with slower tempos, deeper grooves, and lyrics that spoke directly to Jamaica's political climate. Political climate and musical response. The 1970s were a tense period in Jamaica's history. The rivalry between the People's National Party, PNP, and the Jamaica Labour Party, JLP, often spilled into the streets, resulting in violence and community divisions. Internationally, Jamaica's ties with socialist movements and its outspoken stance on global issues made it a voice in the wider post-colonial world. Artists responded in kind. Music became a rallying cry, a form of protest, and a way to unite communities in the face of division. Holt's role in this movement was to bridge worlds, to bring his loyal audience from the ballad years into the more charged environment of Roots reggae without alienating them. Songs of social commentary. One of Holt's earliest forays into overt political commentary came in a track that addressed economic inequality. The lyrics were simple but cutting, focusing on the widening gap between the wealthy elite and the working poor. His delivery was calm, not angry, but the weight of the message was unmistakable. Another notable song from this era painted a picture of the struggles in Kingston's inner-city neighborhoods, from joblessness to rising crime. Holt's approach was observational, describing scenes without sensationalizing them, allowing listeners to draw their own conclusions. Balancing love and resistance. Holt never abandoned love songs, even at the height of his Roots period. Instead, he placed them alongside socially aware tracks on the same albums, creating a balance between intimacy and urgency. This duality made his records accessible to a wider audience. Those who wanted music for the heart and those who wanted music for the conscience. In interviews, Holt explained that love and social justice were not separate themes. Love for people, love for community. That is also part of the struggle, he once said. Influence of Rastafarian ideals. Though Holt was not as publicly associated with Rastafarianism as some of his contemporaries, the movement's values found their way into his work. Songs from this era carried messages of unity, moral strength, and spiritual grounding. Even in tracks without explicit religious references, the influence was clear in his calls for equality and respect. Holt's understated style made these messages approachable for audiences who might have been resistant to more militant voices in reggae. International Roots recognition. Holt's Roots era material began to gain traction overseas, especially in the UK, where the reggae scene was thriving. Sound Systems embraced his politically charged tracks, and they became staples in both West Indian and progressive political circles. This period also saw Holt sharing festival lineups with artists like Burning Spear, Culture, and Dennis Brown, performers whose music defined the Roots reggae movement. His presence alongside them signaled that he was more than a romantic balladeer. He was part of reggae's evolving core. Musical legacy of the Roots period. Holt's Roots recordings never overshadowed his love songs in public memory, but they deepened his artistic legacy. They showed his range, his willingness to adapt, and his refusal to remain in a single category. Today, those tracks stand as a testament to a period when reggae was more than entertainment. It was the heartbeat of a nation grappling with its identity. Holt's contribution was to make that heartbeat resonate with listeners who might have otherwise tuned out the message. By the late 1970s, John Holt had successfully navigated the transition from romantic rocksteady to socially conscious Roots reggae. He stood as one of the few artists who could move fluidly between themes of love and struggle, capturing the full spectrum of Jamaican life in his music. And in the years to come, he would push this balance even further, stepping onto the world stage as a voice for both the heart and the conscience. Chapter 9. International Breakthrough London, 1977, First Headline Show. The lights inside the Hammersmith Odeon dimmed, and a wave of anticipation rolled over the crowd. This wasn't a typical London concert. It was a gathering of Caribbean immigrants, reggae enthusiasts, and curious first-time listeners. Some had grown up on Holt's records in Kingston. Others had discovered him through the growing reggae scene in Britain. When the band struck the first notes of Ali Baba, the audience erupted. Holt walked out in a sharp suit, his posture calm but commanding. The applause was long and loud, the kind reserved for someone who had already won the crowd before singing a single note. By the time he closed the show with Stick By Me, the entire hall was on its feet. That night marked the moment John Holt officially crossed from Jamaican star to international headliner, reggae's growing UK market. By the mid-1970s, reggae had moved well beyond Jamaica's borders. In the UK, the genre found a natural audience among West Indian immigrants who brought their records, sound system culture, and deep musical traditions with them. British-born youth from these communities were blending Jamaican rhythms with local influences, while non-Caribbean listeners were discovering reggae through radio shows, clubs, and festivals. This environment created an opening for artists like Holt. His reputation as both a love song singer and a socially aware performer meant he could appeal to multiple audiences. Romantic ballads drew in older fans and couples, while his roots tracks connected with younger, politically conscious listeners. Partnership with Trojan Records. Trojan Records played a central role in Holt's UK breakthrough. Founded in 1968, the label specialized in bringing Jamaican music to British audiences. By the time Holt signed distribution deals for his albums, Trojan had already built strong retail and radio networks, ensuring that his releases reached not only Caribbean neighborhoods, but also mainstream record shops. The label recognized Holt's crossover potential. They promoted his love songs to mainstream pop audiences while marketing his roots material to reggae purists. This dual approach helped him avoid being pigeonholed and expanded his reach. First, UK tours. Holt's early UK tours were strategic. Rather than performing only in London, he traveled to cities with significant Caribbean populations: Birmingham, Manchester, Bristol, and Leeds. These shows were often hosted in community halls, theaters, and nightclubs that doubled as cultural hubs. Fans recall the intimacy of these concerts. Holt wasn't flashy on stage. His power came from the precision of his voice and the warmth of his presence. Between songs, he spoke directly to the audience, thanking them for supporting Jamaican music abroad. Festival appearances. As reggae's popularity grew, so did the scale of Holt's performances. By the late 1970s, he was appearing at major UK festivals, sharing the stage with acts like Gregory Isaacs, Dennis Brown, and UK-based reggae bands. These events brought together thousands of fans, creating spaces where reggae stood alongside rock, funk, and soul. At these festivals, Holt often tailored his set lists to highlight his versatility. He might open with a roots track, transition into a ballad, and close with a high-energy rocksteady number. This range allowed him to stand out among lineups that sometimes leaned heavily toward one style. Media and press in the UK. Holt's presence in the UK didn't go unnoticed by the media. Music magazines began running interviews and reviews, often praising his ability to captivate a crowd without resorting to showmanship. The BBC featured him on radio programs, giving him exposure beyond reggae's core audience. In print interviews, Holt often spoke about the importance of maintaining authenticity while adapting to new audiences. He resisted pressure to change his sound purely for commercial gain, believing that sincerity was the key to longevity. Building a transatlantic career. The success of Holt's UK performances created a transatlantic rhythm to his career. He would spend months in Jamaica writing and recording, then travel to Britain for tours and promotional appearances. This balance kept him grounded in his roots while expanding his global profile. It also opened doors to collaborations with UK-based musicians and producers. These partnerships introduced subtle new textures to his music, elements of British soul, jazz-inflected arrangements, and more polished production techniques. Cultural connection with the diaspora. For the Jamaican diaspora in Britain, Holt's concerts were more than entertainment. They were cultural affirmations. Hearing his voice live was a reminder of home, of dances in Kingston, late-night radio shows, and the familiar warmth of Caribbean rhythms. Fans often describe these performances as emotional experiences, moments when music bridged the distance between their current lives and their heritage. Holt understood this deeply, treating each show as a shared celebration rather than a one-sided performance. International momentum. Holt's UK breakthrough also caught the attention of promoters in Europe, Canada, and parts of Africa. His ability to sing love songs with universal appeal made him an easy fit for international festivals, while his roots tracks gave him credibility in politically conscious music circles. By the early 1980s, he had established himself as one of reggae's global ambassadors, a role he carried with quiet pride. John Holt's international breakthrough was not a sudden explosion, but a steady, deliberate climb. By building a genuine connection with UK audiences, partnering with a label that understood his range, and staying true to his voice, he transformed from a Jamaican star into a global figure. The next chapter would see him harness this momentum to deliver one of the most politically charged songs of his career, an anthem that would echo far beyond the reggae world. Chapter 10. Police in Helicopter. Kingston, 1983, late night recording session. The studio's air was heavy with cigarette smoke and the hum of equipment. Through the glass, the band was locked into a slow, pulsing groove. The bass throbbed low, the drums crisp and deliberate, the guitar clipped in sharp offbeat chops. John Holt stepped up to the microphone, adjusting his headphones. His eyes were fixed, his voice calm but charged. Police in Helicopter. The words were delivered not in anger, but with a quiet certainty. The tone of a man stating a truth everyone already knew. Outside those studio walls, Jamaica was tense. Helicopters from the Jamaican Constabulary Force had been flying low over rural ganja-growing regions, searching for illegal crops. Farmers were watching their livelihoods disappear in a matter of minutes as aerial raids burned fields that had sustained families for generations. By the end of the night, Holt had recorded a song that would become one of reggae's most enduring protest anthems: the political and social climate. In the early 1980s, Jamaica's ganja trade was under intense pressure from both domestic law enforcement and international agreements with the United States. The U.S. government was pushing for stricter anti-drug enforcement across the Caribbean, and Jamaica, already dealing with economic struggles, was caught between local livelihoods and international politics. Helicopter raids became a symbol of state power. For rural farmers, it wasn't just about losing a crop. It was about losing the ability to feed their families, pay school fees, and keep their communities afloat. These raids also deepened mistrust between rural citizens and government authorities. In Kingston's music scene, artists began addressing the issue through song. Some took militant stances, others approached it with humor. Holt's decision to address it carried extra weight because of his reputation. He wasn't known for political confrontation, which made his statement all the more striking. Holt's approach to protest music. Holt had sung socially aware songs before, but Police in Helicopter was different. It was direct, uncompromising, and left no room for ambiguity. Yet it retained his trademark composure. He didn't shout, he didn't rant. The strength of the song came from its calm defiance. The opening line immediately set the scene. The title itself was powerful, visual, literal, and impossible to ignore. From there, the lyrics laid out a simple message. The raids would not break the spirit of the people, and the fight to preserve their way of life would continue. The recording session. The track was recorded at a Kingston studio known for its crisp, bass-heavy sound. The musicians approached it with a deep respect for the subject matter. The bass line was steady and grounding, the drum pattern spacious but firm, leaving room for Holt's voice to carry the weight of the message. In the control booth, the producer kept playback levels high to feel the physical impact of the rhythm. Each take built intensity without rushing. Holt's delivery was measured. He knew that the quiet confidence in his tone would make the message land harder than any raised voice could. By the time the final take was complete, everyone in the studio knew they had captured something significant. Release and reaction in Jamaica. When Police in Helicopter hit the streets, the reaction was immediate. It became an anthem in rural communities affected by the raids and a rallying cry at dances across the island. Radio stations played it despite its pointed criticism of government policy, in part because Holt's status gave him a level of protection. The song's popularity also made it difficult to suppress. Banning it outright would have risked even more public attention. International resonance. The song's reach extended far beyond Jamaica. In the UK, where reggae fans were deeply connected to Jamaican political issues, Police in Helicopter was embraced as a defiant stand against oppressive authority. In parts of Africa and the Pacific, it resonated with communities facing similar struggles over land and livelihood. Sound systems across Europe made it a staple, and it became one of Holt's most requested tracks during international tours. Its universal message, resistance to unjust control, gave it longevity far beyond the specific circumstances of its creation. Criticism and controversy. While many praised Holt for speaking out, the song also drew criticism. Some government officials viewed it as encouraging illegal activity. Others argued that it oversimplified a complex issue involving international treaties and Jamaica's global standing. Holt, for his part, framed the song not as a defense of the ganja trade specifically, but as a defense of people's right to live without undue interference in their means of survival. Enduring legacy. Decades later, Police in Helicopter remains one of Holt's most iconic recordings. It continues to be played at reggae festivals, covered by younger artists, and sampled in modern tracks. Its hook, simple, visual, and memorable, ensures it remains relevant to new generations discovering Holt's music. The song also cemented his place in reggae's protest tradition. While he would always be celebrated for his romantic ballads, this track proved that he could speak with equal authority on matters of social justice. In 1983, Holt didn't just release another single. He delivered a statement that echoed far beyond Jamaica's shores. Police in Helicopter captured a moment in history with clarity and courage, and in doing so, expanded the boundaries of what his voice could mean. The next phase of his career would see him building on that expanded role, balancing the poet of love with the voice of resistance. Chapter 11, Roots and Reality. Kingston, August 6, 1985, Independence Day Concert. The National Stadium was alive with sound. The steady hum of the crowd, the echo of drums from the opening act, the chatter of vendors selling roasted peanuts and chilled sodas. Flags waved from every corner, red, gold, and green blending with the black, green, and gold of Jamaica's national colors. It was Independence Day, and the concert lineup was a who's who of Jamaican music. As the sun dipped below the horizon, John Holt walked onto the stage in a crisp white suit, microphone in hand. The applause swelled, rolling across the open-air venue. He began not with a love ballad or a protest song, but with a piece that celebrated Jamaican pride, a reminder that his voice was as much a part of the island's identity as the rhythms that shaped it, the bridge between local and global. By the mid-1980s, Holt was more than a singer. He was a cultural ambassador. His music traveled across borders, but it carried with it the unmistakable imprint of Jamaica. Whether he was performing a love song, a roots anthem, or a politically charged track, the essence of Jamaican storytelling, rhythm, and resilience was always present. This bridging role was critical during a period when reggae was gaining new audiences worldwide. Bob Marley's legacy had cemented reggae's global profile, but artists like Holt were ensuring the genre's diversity was represented, showing that reggae could hold space for romance, social commentary, and cultural pride all at once. Cultural identity in the lyrics. Holt's work in this period often reflected Jamaican values and everyday experiences. Songs painted portraits of street life, rural beauty, and the enduring strength of the working class. His lyrics didn't romanticize hardship, but they honored the dignity of people who faced it with courage. He also incorporated phrases and idioms from Jamaican patois, grounding his songs in the rhythms of local speech. This made his music resonate deeply at home while offering international audiences an authentic window into Jamaican culture. Performing at national events. Holt's stature meant he was frequently invited to perform at national celebrations, cultural festivals, and benefit concerts. These events allowed him to sing directly to his fellow Jamaicans, often in moments charged with emotion, whether in times of national pride or collective mourning. At these performances, he often spoke to the crowd between songs, urging unity and reminding them of the cultural richness they carried. His words, delivered in the same measured tone as his singing, carried weight without needing to shout. Reggae's global spread and Holt's role. As reggae continued to expand globally, Holt's music found audiences in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. In Nigeria, Ghana, and South Africa, his songs were embraced as part of the wider Pan-African cultural exchange. In Japan, where reggae had a niche but devoted following, Holt's ballads became collector's items. Touring in these regions allowed Holt to witness firsthand how reggae connected people across vastly different cultures. He often remarked on the similarities he saw, the way audiences thousands of miles from Jamaica understood the struggles and joys his songs described. balancing commercial and cultural commitments. International fame brought opportunities for commercial collaborations, but Holt was selective. He resisted altering his sound to fit fleeting trends, preferring to adapt in ways that didn't compromise his core style. When working with foreign producers, he insisted on retaining Jamaican musicians or incorporating Jamaican rhythms. This ensured that even when his songs were tailored for a broader market, they remained rooted in the sound and spirit of home. Mentoring the next generation. Holt's growing role as a cultural figure also extended to mentorship. Young artists looked to him not only for vocal guidance, but for lessons in professionalism and stagecraft. He advised newcomers on everything from handling sound checks to managing finances, emphasizing that longevity in music came from discipline as much as talent. In interviews, many credited Holt with helping them navigate the pressures of the industry while staying true to their art. Roots reggae as cultural preservation. For Holt, roots reggae wasn't just a style. It was a means of preserving Jamaican history and values. By embedding local stories, proverbs, and references in his songs, he contributed to an oral tradition that reached beyond recorded music. Even in ballads, he would sometimes slip in references to Jamaican landscapes, foods, or social customs, making the songs culturally anchored. This subtle integration helped keep these elements alive in the minds of listeners at home and abroad. A voice for Jamaican unity. Holt's position in Jamaican music allowed him to be a unifying figure during politically divided times. While other artists openly aligned with political parties, Holt's message was consistently about togetherness. This neutrality, combined with his broad appeal, allowed his music to be played and celebrated across social and political lines. By the late 1980s, John Holt had fully embodied the role of a cultural bridge, connecting Jamaica's traditions to the global stage while ensuring that the realities of Jamaican life remained at the heart of his work. Whether singing for tens of thousands at a national celebration or in a small club halfway around the world, he carried the same message. Jamaica's music was not just entertainment. It was identity, history, and pride. Chapter 12. Collaborations and Duets. Kingston, 1987. Tuff Gong Studio. The afternoon sun cut through the high windows of Tuff Gong's main studio, casting soft golden light across the room. The scent of fresh wood polish mixed with the faint tang of solder from recently repaired audio cables. At the center, John Holt stood beside another giant of reggae, Dennis Brown. Between them, a single microphone hung suspended, catching the easy laughter they shared as they worked out the harmonies for their duet. The song was a blend of two worlds: Holt's smooth, measured delivery and Brown's youthful, soul-inflected energy. They ran through the chorus again, tightening the blend until it felt like one voice split into two tones. By the time the tape rolled, there was no sense of competition, only the joy of two seasoned artists lifting each other higher. The art of the reggae collaboration. In reggae's golden years, collaborations were more than marketing strategies. They were cultural conversations. Artists came together not to merge fan bases, but to share styles, ideas, and musical philosophies. Holt thrived in this environment. His adaptable voice made him an ideal partner, able to match energy levels, shift between lead and harmony roles, and mold his tone to complement another's. Producers recognized this quality early on. When they wanted a duet that balanced romance with maturity or social commentary with calm authority, Holt was on the shortlist. Studio partnerships. Throughout the 1980s and 1990s, Holt recorded with an impressive range of reggae talents. Sessions with Dennis Brown, Gregory Isaacs, Freddie McGregor, and Sugar Minot stand out for their chemistry and shared respect. Each collaboration had its own flavor. With Gregory Isaacs, the sessions leaned toward lovers rock, their voices weaving in and out like two storytellers swapping verses. With Freddie McGregor, the energy shifted toward roots and conscious themes, each singer reinforcing the other's message. Holt approached these projects with humility. He entered sessions prepared, often knowing his partner's catalog well enough to suggest subtle melodic nods that fans would catch. Duets on stage. Live performances brought another layer to Holt's collaborations. Festivals and multi-artist concerts often featured impromptu duets, where Holt would step up beside another singer mid-song. One memorable moment came at Reggae Sunsplash, where Holt joined Gregory Isaacs on stage for a surprise performance of Let's Fall in Love Again. The crowd, already charged from Isaacs' set, erupted when Holt walked on. Without rehearsal, they fell into a natural harmony, trading lines and smiles as if they'd been singing together for years. These spontaneous moments often became fan highlights, reminders that reggae's community spirit extended beyond the studio. Cross-generational collaborations. As reggae evolved into the 1990s and 2000s, Holt sought out opportunities to work with younger artists. His collaborations with singers from the Lovers Rock Revival and Modern Roots movement helped bridge the gap between eras. Younger performers spoke of how Holt made space for them in the studio, never overshadowing their contributions. He viewed these partnerships as part of his responsibility to keep reggae's vocal traditions alive, blending styles and themes. One of Holt's strengths in duets was his ability to merge different thematic directions. If a partner wanted to lean heavily into romantic storytelling, Holt could match that tone without losing his own style. If the track demanded a shift toward social consciousness, he adjusted seamlessly. This adaptability was not just vocal, it was emotional. Holt's performances always felt grounded in genuine feeling, making even the most polished studio tracks resonate with sincerity. International collaborative work. Beyond Jamaica, Holt recorded with artists in the UK reggae scene, including Lovers Rock icons like Janet Kay and Carol Thompson. These projects often introduced his voice to audiences who knew reggae primarily through its softer, romantic expressions. In Europe, he appeared on collaborative bills with African reggae artists, trading verses in performances that blended Caribbean and African musical sensibilities. These events reinforced reggae's global reach and its shared language of rhythm and resistance. The legacy of his duets. Holt's collaborative work stands as a testament to his versatility and generosity as an artist. Many of these songs remain fan favorites, not only for their musical quality, but for the way they capture reggae's communal heart. Younger artists continue to cite these partnerships as examples of how established musicians can work with emerging talent without ego or creative conflict. In a genre where individuality is celebrated, Holt's duets prove that unity could be just as powerful. John Holt's collaborations and duets added depth to his already rich catalog. They showcased his ability to adapt, to share the spotlight, and to create music that was more than the sum of its parts. Whether standing beside a fellow veteran or lifting up a new voice, Holt brought the same calm authority and open-hearted artistry that defined his entire career. The next chapter would turn away from the stage and spotlight, focusing instead on the man behind the music, his family life, values, and the private world that shaped the public figure. Chapter 13, Late Career and Mentorship. Kingston, 1994, Small Studio in Halfway Tree. The midday sun poured through a half-open louvered window, catching dust motes that floated lazily in the warm air. Inside, the studio was alive with the low throb of a bass line and the occasional burst of laughter from the control booth. John Holt sat on a stool, leaning slightly forward, listening intently as a young singer ran through a verse. When the take ended, Holt didn't jump in with criticism. He waited a beat, then offered a few words, measured, specific, and encouraging. The young singer nodded, took a breath, and stepped back to the microphone. It was the kind of quiet guidance Holt had been giving for years, a mix of patience and precision that reflected his own journey. By the mid-1990s, Holt was no longer chasing chart dominance. He was building something less visible but equally lasting, a role as a mentor, an anchor, and a standard bearer for reggae's vocal tradition. Shifting focus. After decades of touring and recording, Holt began choosing projects more selectively. The demands of constant travel gave way to a balanced schedule that left room for personal life and mentorship. His own performances continued, but he was increasingly drawn to working with emerging talent. Many younger singers were stepping into a reggae landscape that had changed. Dancehall was dominating local airwaves, digital rhythms were replacing full band arrangements, and international audiences were dividing their attention between roots revival acts and crossover pop hits. Holt understood these shifts, but he also believed that strong vocals and timeless songwriting could outlast any trend, guiding the next generation. Holt's mentorship wasn't a formal program. It was something that happened organically. A singer might seek him out after a show, or a producer might pair him with a new voice in the studio. He would share techniques for breath control, phrasing, and emotional delivery. He often reminded younger artists that a good song is more than a melody. It's a feeling you carry in your voice before the music even starts. Many protégés recall how Holt would demonstrate by singing a single line, instantly showing how subtle changes in tone or timing could transform the impact. Collaborations with younger artists. In the 1990s and early 2000s, Holt recorded several tracks with rising stars. These collaborations often blended his classic delivery with newer production styles, bridging generational gaps. Producers valued these pairings. Holt's presence brought credibility to younger acts, while the fresh energy of his collaborators kept his own work connected to evolving reggae trends. One particularly well-received track paired Holt with a roots revival singer, their voices trading verses about love and perseverance over a modern one-drop rhythm. It became a modest hit in both Jamaica and the UK, proving that his adaptability remained intact. Festival appearances. Holt's later years included regular appearances at major reggae festivals such as Reggae Sumfest, Rebel Salute, and international events in Europe and Africa. These stages often placed him alongside both his contemporaries and artists two generations younger. At these shows, Holt's sets became lessons in vocal control and audience connection. He could still glide through ballads with the same ease as decades before, but he also knew when to inject energy into roots tracks that spoke to broader struggles. Audiences responded not just to the songs, but to the respect he commanded without demanding it, balancing past and present in performances. Holt's concert set lists in this period were carefully constructed. He gave fans the classics they came for. Stick By Me, The Tide Is High, Police and Helicopter. But he also introduced new material and reworked older songs with updated arrangements. This kept his performances fresh, both for audiences and for himself. He avoided nostalgia as the sole draw, instead using his history as a foundation for continued creativity. Upholding professional standards. Part of Holt's mentorship involved modeling professionalism. He was known for punctuality, preparedness, and respect for everyone involved in a production, from sound engineers to stagehands. In an industry where talent is abundant but reliability is rare, these qualities made him a valuable collaborator. Younger artists often remarked that working with Holt taught them as much about conduct as about craft. Cultural preservation. In addition to personal mentorship, Holt took an active interest in preserving reggae's history. He supported projects that documented the genre's roots, contributed to archival releases, and participated in interviews that captured firsthand accounts of Jamaica's musical evolution. He saw this as part of his responsibility, ensuring that future generations understood not just the music, but the circumstances and communities that shaped it. By the late 2000s, John Holt had fully embraced his dual role. Still a performer of the highest caliber, but also a mentor and guardian of reggae's vocal heritage. His later years were not a slow fade, but a steady giving back, passing on skills, values, and a belief in the power of a song well sung. The next chapter would bring us into the quieter side of his life, revealing the private man behind the public figure. Chapter 14. Personal Life and Private Man. Kingston, Sunday afternoon, early 2000s. The street outside was quiet except for the occasional passing car. Inside the gate of a modest but well-kept home, children's laughter drifted from the backyard, mixing with the scent of curry goat and rice steaming from the kitchen. A radio played softly in the living room, tuned to a station that was, on this day, spinning a familiar voice, John Holt's. He sat in a wicker chair near the back veranda, out of sight of the road, sipping a cup of tea. The world outside might have been full of tours, interviews, and stage lights, but here it was still. The conversations were about family milestones, neighbors, and what needed fixing around the house. Never about record sales or concert reviews. This was the John Holt few fans ever saw. Not the sharply dressed man holding a microphone under spotlights, but the quiet family man who valued privacy over publicity. A conscious separation of public and private life. Holt learned early in his career that fame could be consuming. The constant requests for appearances, the unending cycle of travel, and the press attention could easily pull an artist into living entirely for the stage. He made a deliberate choice to separate his public work from his private life. While he gave freely of himself on stage, he guarded his home life closely. Interviews rarely touched on his family, and photographers seldom captured him outside of performance contexts. This wasn't secrecy born of distrust, it was preservation. Holt wanted a place where the world's expectations couldn't follow him, where he could simply be a father, a partner, a neighbor. Family as anchor. Those close to Holt describe him as deeply devoted to his family. His schedule often revolved around ensuring he could be present for important moments, birthdays, graduations, anniversaries. Even when touring internationally, he kept in frequent contact, calling home from hotel rooms or leaving voice messages if time zones made direct conversation difficult. He carried photos of loved ones in his travel bag, a small but constant reminder of the life waiting for him beyond the stage. Family gatherings were warm and unpretentious. Holt enjoyed cooking for relatives, sometimes insisting on preparing a favorite dish himself, even if others offered to help. Food, conversation, and music, not performances but shared sing-alongs, were the hallmarks of these moments. A man of routine. In his private life, Holt valued routine. Mornings often began with tea or coffee, a brief walk outside, and quiet reading of the day's news. When home in Kingston, he liked to tend to the small garden in his yard, taking satisfaction in watching plants grow and bloom. Neighbors recall seeing him wave from his veranda or stop for brief, friendly chats. Despite his fame, he never created barriers with those around him. He blended into the rhythm of the community, a familiar face rather than a distant celebrity. Faith and grounding values. While Holt did not often speak publicly about religion, those close to him say his faith was a steady, personal presence in his life. It shaped his values: respect for others, humility, and a commitment to doing good without fanfare. He supported charitable efforts quietly, donating to community projects and helping individuals in need without attaching his name to the contributions. To him, generosity was a personal duty, not a publicity opportunity. Navigating fame's pressures. The 24-hour accessibility of the modern entertainment world, with its instant photography, tabloid reporting, and online chatter, was not something Holt embraced. He preferred to let his work speak for itself rather than chase headlines. This approach sometimes puzzled younger artists, who were encouraged to be constantly visible. But Holt's career longevity was proof that a strong catalog and consistent performances could sustain an artist without the need for constant exposure. Personal passions outside music. Beyond his love for music, Holt had a quiet appreciation for craftsmanship. He enjoyed woodworking, repairing furniture, and small home projects. Friends recall him spending hours adjusting the sound on his home stereo system, not because it needed fixing, but because he enjoyed the process of perfecting it. He also had a love for cricket, following both Jamaican teams and international matches. Game days often found him with a radio nearby, listening between other tasks. Protecting the next generation. Holt was protective of younger family members when it came to the public eye. He believed that fame was something to be managed, not chased, and he often advised them to build their own identities outside of his legacy. When relatives showed interest in music, he supported them, but with the same measured advice he gave to any young artist: master your craft, respect the work, and never let the spotlight define you. In a world where celebrity often erases the private self, John Holt held firm to the life he had built beyond the stage. His home was not an extension of his career but a refuge from it, a place where the man could breathe free of the legend. And in those quiet spaces, among family and close friends, he nurtured the values that would carry into the final years of his career and the legacy he left behind. Chapter 15. Final Performances. London, August 2014. One Love Festival. The summer evening air carried the scent of food stalls, jerk chicken, fried plantain, and sweet festival bread. A low hum of conversation rippled through the crowd as the sun dipped toward the horizon. On the main stage, the band was already in place, checking instruments, the bass guitar sending deep, steady pulses into the warm night. When John Holt appeared, the applause was instant and deep. Some in the crowd had grown up with his music playing in their parents' homes. Others had discovered him through the vinyl revival sweeping the UK. For all of them, this was more than a concert. It was a meeting with a voice that had been part of their lives for decades. Holt stepped up to the microphone in a dark suit and crisp white shirt. His posture was steady, his expression calm. As the first chords of Stick By Me began, he smiled faintly. The song rolled out smooth and confident, the years in his voice adding a richness that wasn't there in his youth, but the clarity was still intact. A seasoned performer. By the time of his final tours, Holt's performances had a distilled quality. Every movement, every pause, every glance toward the audience was deliberate. There was no need for grand gestures. The audience came for the sound, the history, and the feeling his voice carried. He often began sets with classics, moving seamlessly from rocksteady hits to roots anthems, carefully pacing the energy. Ballads still drew the deepest connection, with couples swaying and singing every word. But protest songs like Police and Helicopter still sent a ripple of energy through the crowd. International farewell circuits. In his last years, Holt toured selectively, focusing on festivals and venues that offered the right setting for his music. The UK remained a stronghold, but he also performed in Canada, the United States, and parts of the Caribbean. Each show felt like an unspoken farewell. While Holt didn't make public announcements about slowing down, fans sensed the significance. In smaller venues, people crowded near the stage, leaning forward during quieter moments, as if to hold on to every note, adjusting the performance. Time changes every voice, and Holt understood how to adapt. He lowered certain keys to match his range, adjusted phrasing to preserve breath control, and used the natural depth in his tone to give older songs a new dimension. Far from diminishing the experience, these adjustments often deepen the emotional impact. Songs like A Love I Can Feel gained a reflective weight, resonating with both the singer and the listeners who had lived with the music for decades. The bond with the audience. In his final shows, Holt spoke more to the crowd between songs. He would share brief stories about how a track was written, or recall a performance from years past in that same city. His tone was always conversational, as though speaking to old friends rather than fans. At a 2013 concert in Birmingham, he paused mid-set to thank the audience for keeping the music alive and for letting these songs belong to you. The applause that followed lasted nearly a full minute. Festival highlights. Festival settings in Holt's final years offered unique moments. At Rebel Salute in Jamaica, he performed under a moonlit sky, the breeze carrying his voice across the outdoor venue. Younger artists stood in the wings, watching intently, a quiet acknowledgement of the influence he held. In Europe, Holt's sets often ended with standing ovations, the crowd chanting his name until he returned for an encore. Sometimes it was the tide is high, other times a deep cut that longtime fans knew by heart. Health and determination. In the months leading up to his final performances, Holt's health began to challenge him. There were nights when fatigue showed, and others when he conserved his energy by shortening sets. Yet he refused to compromise on quality. If he stepped on stage, he gave the audience everything he could in that moment. Close friends and musicians noted that performing still energized him, even on difficult days. The connection with the audience, the shared history in the songs, seemed to renew him, if only for the length of the set. The final UK appearances. The One Love Festival in August 2014 became one of Holt's last major UK performances. Reviews described it as both powerful and bittersweet. Critics noted that while the set leaned on familiar material, each song felt fresh in its delivery, as though Holt knew the crowd was listening more closely than usual. Photographs from the night show him smiling warmly, hands outstretched toward the audience. The lighting caught the edges of his suit jacket, framing him in a soft glow that seemed almost symbolic. The final chapter illuminated. In those final performances, John Holt wasn't simply revisiting his past. He was affirming it. Every lyric, every pause between verses, was a thread connecting his earliest days in Greenwich Town to the global stages he had graced. As the last notes faded into applause, he left the stage the same way he had entered it decades earlier, with quiet dignity, letting the music speak for him. Chapter 16. Passing and Tributes. London, October 2014. The stage lights were still cooling from the last of John Holt's performances, just months earlier. In a quiet hospital room, far from the roar of audiences and the glow of festival spotlights, Holt lay surrounded by close family members. His health had been in decline for some time, but few outside his immediate circle knew the extent. Those final days were filled with gentle conversation, shared memories, and music, soft, familiar songs playing quietly in the background. It was in this stillness, in the early hours of October 19, 2014, that John Holt's voice finally went silent. He was 69 years old. The news breaks. Word of Holt's passing reached Jamaica within hours. Radio stations interrupted their regular programming to play his songs, starting with Stick By Me and Police and Helicopter. News anchors spoke his name with a mix of reverence and disbelief. social media feeds filled with messages from fans who had grown up with his voice. The initial shock quickly gave way to reflection. For many, Holt had been more than a singer. He had been a constant presence, a thread tying together generations through his music. Official statements. In Jamaica, the Ministry of Culture issued a statement honoring Holt's contributions to the island's cultural heritage. John Holt's voice was part of the soundtrack of our national identity, it read. His music carried the spirit of Jamaica across the world and will continue to inspire. Prime Minister Portia Simpson Miller called Holt a treasure whose songs will forever echo the resilience and romance of our people. Musical community reactions. Fellow musicians, from reggae pioneers to young rising stars, shared their memories. Barris Hammond. He showed us that you could sing about love with strength and about struggle with grace. Dennis Brown's family. John was a brother to Dennis in music and in life. We are comforted knowing they will be harmonizing together again. Freddie McGregor. When John walked into a studio, you knew you were about to be part of something that would last forever. Sound system selectors across Jamaica and abroad dedicated entire sets to Holt's catalog, blending his early rocksteady hits with the later roots and lovers rock classics. Public mourning in Jamaica. In Kingston, murals began appearing almost overnight. Painted tributes on walls and shopfronts showing Holt with his microphone, sometimes framed by the colors of the Jamaican flag. A memorial vigil was organized at National Heroes Park, where fans gathered to sing his songs under the open night sky. The atmosphere was a mix of sadness and celebration. Tears fell, but so did the rhythm of drums, reminding everyone that Holt's music was meant to be lived with, not just listened to. Tributes abroad. In London, where Holt had performed many of his most celebrated shows, a tribute concert was quickly organized at the O2 Academy in Brixton. Artists from across the reggae spectrum took the stage, performing Holt's songs in their own styles. Some audiences wept quietly during "The Tide Is High." Others danced to "Ali Baba" with smiles through the tears. In Africa, radio DJs in Ghana and Nigeria aired special programming dedicated to Holt's influence, pointing out how his songs had crossed oceans without losing their authenticity. In Japan, collectors and fans held listening sessions, playing original vinyl pressings late into the night. Media retrospectives. Major newspapers and music magazines published retrospectives, tracing Holt's career from his Greenwich Town childhood to his final performances. The BBC ran a feature segment calling him the Gentleman of Reggae, noting his ability to remain both relevant and respected over decades of shifting trends. These tributes often emphasized Holt's balance, the rare ability to dominate romantic ballads and still deliver credible protest anthems, uniting audiences across tastes and generations. The funeral. Holt's funeral was held in Kingston in November 2014, drawing a crowd that filled the church and spilled into the streets. Musicians performed his songs between eulogies from family, friends, and cultural figures. The casket, adorned with flowers, was carried out to the sound of "Stick By Me." Outside, the gathered crowd sang along, their voices rising over the steady heartbeat of drums. Legacy in the aftermath. In the weeks following his passing, radio play of Holt's catalog surged. Record stores reported renewed demand for both his solo albums and Paragon's era releases. Streaming platforms saw spikes in plays, especially from younger listeners discovering him for the first time. A proposal was made to name a Kingston street in his honor, ensuring that his presence would remain part of the city's daily life. John Holt's passing marked the end of a singular voice in Jamaican music, but not the end of his influence. In the days and nights that followed, his songs rang out from dance halls, car stereos, and living rooms around the world. In grief and gratitude, people sang along, proving that while the man was gone, the music would keep carrying his name, his pride, and his Jamaica into the future. Chapter 17. Legacy and Pride. Kingston Waterfront, present day. The afternoon sun glints off the blue waters of Kingston Harbor. Along the waterfront, a group of young musicians gathers under the shade of an almond tree. They're rehearsing, acoustic guitars in hand, their voices weaving together in harmonies that are unmistakably inspired by the rocksteady and lovers rock eras. One of them leans into the microphone and begins to sing. "Stick by me, I'll stick by you." The words float across the street, and an older man sitting on a bench nearby nods in recognition. He remembers when that song first came out in 1972, remembers hearing it on the radio while walking to work. For these young musicians, the song is history. For him, it's memory. For both, it's John Holt, more than a voice. John Holt's career spanned over 5 decades, yet his music remains present. Not as nostalgia, but as part of the living fabric of Jamaican and global music culture. His voice, rich and steady, carried emotion without excess. He was a master of restraint, allowing the weight of a lyric to carry through clear delivery and precise phrasing. But Holt's impact went beyond the songs themselves. He represented a model of professionalism and longevity in an industry often defined by rapid rise and fall. For young artists, his career is proof that staying true to one's craft, without constant reinvention for trend's sake, can lead to enduring respect. Influence on generations of musicians. From the moment he stepped on stage as a teenager, Holt was shaping the sound of Jamaica. The Paragons introduced a harmony style that would influence vocal groups for decades. His solo work demonstrated the power of a singer-songwriter who could move between love ballads and social commentary without losing credibility in either realm. Artists like Barris Hammond, Gregory Isaacs, and Sanchez have cited Holt as an influence, not just in vocal style, but in the balance between romantic and roots reggae. International acts, including UB40 and Blondie, drew from his catalog, covering his songs and carrying them to audiences far outside the Caribbean. Even in the digital era, reggae producers continue to version Holt's rhythms. Tracks like Ali Baba and Police and Helicopter are sampled, remixed, and reinterpreted, showing that the foundation he built remains relevant for contemporary listeners. Cultural symbol of Jamaica. Holt's image and voice became cultural markers of Jamaica abroad. At international festivals, when he sang songs like Sweetie Come Brush Me or Let's Build Our Dreams, he wasn't just performing. He was presenting an authentic piece of Jamaican artistry. Tourists returning from the island often carried his music home alongside memories of the beaches and markets, making Holt's voice an unofficial ambassador of the country's warmth and style. In the Jamaican diaspora, particularly in the UK and Canada, Holt's music played at weddings, christenings, and community gatherings. It became part of the soundtrack of immigrant life, a reminder of home. Preservation of the rocksteady tradition. While reggae evolved into roots, dancehall, and beyond, Holt never abandoned the rocksteady sensibility that shaped him. His arrangements favored clarity, the space between instruments, the tightness of the rhythm section, the prominence of the vocals. Music historians often credit Holt with keeping rocksteady's melodic structure alive during the rise of roots reggae in the 1970s. By carrying that sound forward, he ensured that new generations could trace the lineage of Jamaican music from ska to reggae without losing the middle chapter. Educational and archival recognition. In recent years, Holt's work has been the subject of university lectures, musicology papers, and archival projects. The Jamaica Music Museum holds rare recordings, photographs, and stage outfits from his career, preserving them for research and public display. Documentaries on reggae's global journey frequently include Holt's story, noting his crossover success in the UK and his role in shaping the romantic subgenre that became known as lover's rock. Honors and awards. Though Holt was never one to chase accolades, they came naturally over time. He received Jamaica's Order of Distinction for his contributions to the nation's music. Posthumously, he was honored at the Reggae Gold Awards and featured in memorial segments at major reggae festivals worldwide. Plans for a commemorative statue in Kingston have been discussed, with proposals to place it in a public space where both locals and visitors can encounter it daily, living legacy through the next generation. Family members and proteges have continued Holt's musical lineage. Some have entered the industry directly, performing his songs in tribute or creating original work that draws from his style. In music workshops, young singers study Holt's phrasing, learning how to communicate emotion without over-singing. This approach, sometimes called the Holt discipline, has become part of vocal training in certain Jamaican music programs. Global streams and new audiences. The digital music era has opened Holt's work to entirely new audiences. Streaming platforms place his songs alongside contemporary artists, allowing younger listeners to discover him without the limitations of record stores or radio programming. Analytics show spikes in his catalog plays whenever reggae-themed TV series, films, or commercials feature his music. In this way, his legacy grows quietly, reaching listeners who may not yet know his full story. pride as the enduring theme. In interviews throughout his career, Holt often spoke about pride, not in an arrogant sense, but as a deep satisfaction in representing his country, his generation, and his style of music with dignity. This pride was evident in his stage presence, in the way he carried himself in public, and in his commitment to the quality of his work. Even when facing health challenges, he insisted on delivering performances that honored both his audience and his own standards. Today, whether in a vinyl collector's library, a streaming playlist, or a live tribute show, John Holt's voice continues to travel. His songs bridge generations, carrying with them the stories, emotions, and rhythms of Jamaica. For those who knew his music when it was new, each note brings back a part of their own history. For those discovering him now, it's an introduction to a standard of artistry that remains rare. And for Jamaica, his legacy stands as both heritage and pride, a reminder that while artists pass on, the truth of their music has no expiration date.